people can really get through anything when there's a sense of community. Community and connection is just such a huge factor in people's success, like just for themselves, like not successful as in money, but successful just to feel good.
Hard work, work.
Hard work, that's what they say.
Hard work, work.
Hard work, I earn my pay.
Hard work, work.
Hard work, do it every day.
Well, welcome once again to another Work Ethic podcast. And I am connecting today with Katie Ray. And Katie, thank you so much for taking some time to sit down with me.
I am so glad we got connected. I'm super excited to be here. I'm also a host of a podcast, Not a Great Whisperer podcast. I think we have a lot of things in common. We just really want to help people. And I'm one of those people that enjoy how people got to where they are, kind of what obstacles they've conquered. And I've worked in sales and marketing for a really long time, over 10 years. I'm an old soul and I just really enjoy meeting new people. I'm just super lame and I like hearing people's stories. So thanks for having me. I'm so glad we got connected.
I like hearing people's stories as well. And I know, I mean, you and I think I was looking at your podcast and I immediately was like, I saw you're at like 86 episodes or something. Yeah. And I was like, okay, when did you start that? And I scroll back and I was like, oh, it was May 2019. Uh-huh. So I think mine's the first episode I put up was actually my now wife was the first episode, was
really?
July, July. That's not how we met, but like
no,
we were about to get married already, yeah. But like the, yeah, I wanted her to be the first episode of the podcast. So we did that. I actually, to be honest, I interviewed the second guest before her, but I was like, I promised her I'd air whatever. So yeah, we started about the same time, it looks like.
Yeah.
And I know for me, it's been just such a incredible journey in getting to meet new folks and connect with folks. I'm curious about just, I don't know, because I want to ask you a million things about a million different things that I've seen that you've done, but just, I don't know. Tell us about that. Like, how's that been? Or tell us a little bit more about your show and then what that process has been like for you, like why you did it and then how it's been.
So I finally just decided to pull the trigger and go out on my own. I'm working for VCAN Creative now, but I was first a client with them.
Mm-hmm.
They're in Ybor. And I went there for a headshot for my consulting to do lead generation and things like that in IT industry and just all industries. And I went there and I told them how I wanted to start a podcast. I had just kind of gotten into the cannabis industry, medical marijuana here, which is another funny story because that's full circle because I have a felony charge from growing weed in college, but nice. Then I was able to legally sell it now as my age is what, 15 years later, but mm-hmm. It's not funny, but it's kind of fucked up. Excuse my language. It's kind of messed up at the same time. But I started getting into the cannabis industry, but I still wanted to do what I knew best and consult. So I told them how I wanted to start a podcast. I wanted to interview people. I think everybody has a great story. Ordinary people live in extraordinary lives. And Kevin, the CEO of VCAN, looked at me and I had so many different things I said. And he goes, we'll do it all. And they made my website and they did the sales part. They did speaking event stuff for like addiction because I am a wife of a recovering addict. Mm-hmm. I am very focused on all minority groups being leveled up really and being pushed to succeed. And then my dad, who is gay and came out when I was in seventh grade, that's a very, very sensitive subject for me because I am very big on loving people for good character. So I also like to go in around youth and just let them know they're supported, they're loved, you know, be who you want to be. Because that was a hard time in my family's life, but now we do holidays together. My dad's remarried, my mom's remarried. Everybody is happy. My kids know two grandpas over here, grandma and grandpa over here. Like it's just life. So I was just very big on that. And when I spewed all that stuff out, Kevin from VCAN was like, I can do that. We can get you where you want. I was like, are you sure? Everyone always says you need a niche. And he's like, no, like do your contract IT stuff and then do what you want for people. So,
yeah.
You know. Here I am.
That's awesome. So there's so many questions I have in there. All right, let's start with VCAN. So you kind of flesh out. So they're a marketing creative.
Yeah, full digital. Yes. So we're very family oriented to LGBT certified. Two husbands run the show, Brandon and Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Just like family, it's about seven of us. And we do everything, video production, photography, everything. They come from a background of agencies, very artsy. I'm more of the operations side. Mm-hmm. I like to surround myself with a lot of creatives because they're awesome, but don't ask me to draw something or take a picture or do a video. They made me do like a background scene. It did not come out good.
Well, that's good. That's it well illustrates the value of diversity among skill sets or whatever. We need each other. So you got a felony growing weed in college?
I did. I have a cultivation charge. It sounds fancy.
I love it.
So I am the face of an ex-felon. It was a very hard time. I mean, only kid to graduate college, only kid to get arrested, right? Not probably the best.
You have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have an older brother and two older sisters. So okay. I was a baby. But then my mom remarried, and then I have a younger brother and younger sister.
Okay.
It wasn't a fun time. But for me, it really, I had to step up, right? You don't have, when you have to prove yourself again, I had a lot of professors who were like, I'll tell the judge anything you need me to write for you. Because I worked hard. I worked at the casino in Chili's, and I decided to grow weed. And my ex and I, you know, you just used to out, you, potheads are great. It was the other drugs that came into my house. So you don't surround yourself with really the right people, and that gets to happen. Not the people who enjoyed our plants like us, but so I'm a very, I am an advocate for CBD, for, I'm very, very much, anything can be abused, right? But I'm a very strong advocate for that. And so when I went into cannabis industry for about a year and a half and was an assistant manager at a dispensary, it was medicine to people, you know, like when you're helping those people with Parkinson's, when you're helping those kids who have seizures, like it is 100% medicine. So yeah. I full circled. It took a minute for me to get approved to dispense because of my felony.
Really?
And I'm like, the felony is weed though. Like, so why would I?
I was doing the thing that I want to do. Right?
I should probably get, and you know that imaginary boundary of states. Like I probably could have gone to Colorado and showed them my resume and they'd be like, Walgreens is your client. Go fill our dispensaries. But at the same time, it wasn't a smart decision. It's illegal, like make smarter choices. So sure. I was glad I woke up because some of it's like a little hazy to me. Some of the memories I have with that time, because you know, you let money kind of run and you just, it was very traumatic for my family.
How old were you?
I was 21.
Yeah.
And now I'm 36 in May, so.
Okay. All right.
Every time I like bring it up, I'm like, oh my gosh, it was so long ago, but it won't ever get expunged. I've been denied 3 times because we're not rec yet. So if we're ever rec in Florida, then I can expunge it.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the things about the entire industry that's been hard. I mean, and just an inevitability of it being from criminalized to decriminalized to medical to whatever. It's just like how many people are
in jail
or can't be employed, you know, it's like, and then what opportunity it represents to so many people now. I mean, it's a booming industry.
Through COVID, through like the first hit of COVID, everything shut down, not dispensary.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like, I laugh about it just because I'm a person of laugh. I don't mean it like that, but
sure.
Like it really rips my heart out. The people that are still in jail or have served that much time. Cause I am not, someone who was, I was in jail for 2 days.
Really?
My parents were divorced. They put both their houses up for my bail. So wow. Hillsborough County. So it's like, here's privilege right here, folks. Like I was able to have that, but
yeah. Get lawyers and yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get bail and lawyers, you got a whole different experience.
Totally different experience.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, I don't want to ever go back to jail. Like that's just not an experience. I was in general population in Hillsborough County. Like, if you want a scared straight episode, I could have been in that show.
Yeah.
100%.
You're like, okay.
Like, oh, no, 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 no.
You've been good ever since.
I've been good. Yes. Yes, I have been good.
That's
I have
good.
3 kids. I have been good. Yeah.
How old are your kids?
I have a 7-year-old boy. I have a 5-year-old girl and a 1-year-old girl. All through infertility. So we had to do IVF for all of them.
Really?
Yeah. That was another journey.
I'm injecting myself
with drugs. Like I'm injecting myself with drugs.
Yeah.
On top of hormones. So always hated needles. I would have been a nurse. if I liked needles or blood tests or anything like that. And then I knew God was like laughing and like, you hate needles? You're gonna have to give yourself injections. And I was like, oh my gosh, why? Did that. I did it 4 times, 3 successful. That is I don't know how it happened. It's a hard journey. We are very blessed. I mean, very blessed on that. Those are I wouldn't wish infertility on my worst enemy.
Yeah.
It's just it's a very emotional roller coaster of, because you're happy for people, but you're not happy for people. You're like, oh, I can't have kids naturally, but I want them. Because I was an aunt at 10 years old. My brother had kids early and I loved my nephew. Like it was just like, you know, and some people don't want kids. Okay. But I knew I did. And I loved being an aunt. So I was like, oh, I can't wait to be a mom.
Yeah. I'm sure if that's something, I mean, I've known women too. There's like, that's something they desperately want. And like, broken or inadequate or like all these things that kind of come with that, like what I should be able to do. And it seems like a really traumatic experience really to have to deal with. But thank God there is shots and
procedures. Science is cool too.
I mean, kids are all healthy and never had any issues with any of those. That's
so good. My last one was, I call her the freezer baby. She was the frozen embryos from 4 years ago from my daughter. There's a funny little meme that says, started from the freezer, now I'm here. I have to get a picture of her next to that little thing because it's true. Which is crazy to me. Science is crazy to me. It's just crazy.
How does that happen? Back up, because what are we talking about?
So it's an embryo. So they take my egg. I love these signs. I love this. Okay. Good. So they take my egg, my husband's sperm, mix it together. They made the embryo. Well, I only implanted one for my daughter, Juliana, who's 5 now. So the rest of her batch that fertilized, they put in a freezer, like right next to the frozen meat. No, I'm just kidding.
That's amazing. Seriously?
So you have to pay for this storage yearly. And I was like, you know what? It takes me a while to get healthy. Feel healthy again after pregnancy. So I was like, I'm almost 36. Like, let's just do it. Let's see if it works. If it doesn't, close chapter. The end. Because I'm not doing, I won't do the cycles again. That messes with your body. Much. We did that and she was frozen embryos. They implanted 2 and 1 took. Sometimes you get twins, sometimes you don't. But we got 1 and my son was our very first cycle and, he was 2 embryos too. So I always say they dissolve, but I messed up. It's nothing. But it's just like, it dissolves. So, you know, we're super lucky. I had a failed one between my daughter and son, just a failed cycle and it doesn't take, but you know, that's it's an emotional ride because, you know, time, it's just, I started early. I didn't have any, people are always like, oh, I can't believe your kids are born in December. That's horrible for them. I didn't plan it. Like I was just trying to cycle.
Sure. And why is that horrible? Right. No. I mean, I get like, oh, because they're Christmas presents or something. It's like
people
brought into this world. What are you talking about? So speaking of kids and not your kids at this point, but I'm curious about you. Historically, so I try to ask folks that I talk to, like, about when you were young, if you think back, what are your earliest memories of work, or what are your earliest memories when work took on meaning in your life? The word, what is work? How did you figure that out? What did it mean to you when you were young?
So it was just, I was 13 and I started bussing tables at the restaurant my sister and my mom worked at. And on days off of school, and on weekends, I had to bus tables. And I hated it at first. And I was like, Mom, all my friends are, you know, doing this. But I knew it. I just had to have, that's what my family did. We worked. So on like days off, I would bus their tables. I'd collect money. But I loved earning money from my work. And again, I loved meeting people and chatting with people. So, you know, it was just something you had to do. You had to work. And my dad is a workaholic, like nursing school, bartending when we all were young. My mom was a teacher and then taking care of. So it's like, it's just something I knew. But I was in hospitality till like 23. Really? So restaurant, yeah, casino. So I just, that's what I knew at first. So it's just something we had to do, right? And I did like it. I hated missing my friends going to the beach or something, or yeah, a Friday football game. But in high school, I was able to take like some weekends off. So
I'm curious. So a lot of times when I ask you about the earliest memories of work, and this could be, they could be the same, but a lot of times like, what, 13, I start bussing tables, which was a job. But I am curious about if you can go, if you push yourself back further a little bit, like maybe not just, so like apart from employment even, so it could be sport, could be school, could be perspective on mom and dad, but like even if you thought about the word itself, right? Like, so somewhere along the way, the word comes to, we come to think it means employment, right? And in a lot of ways it does. You work at a job and they pay you to be there and you make money and you earn money for your work when you're there. But I am curious about just the idea of like things you had to work at or learn, like just, I don't know. I'm just curious what might come up as you think back.
So now I know the work I did as a child, but while I was doing it, I didn't know. So I love how you put that. I was in travel softball, basketball leagues. My sister coached me. The work I put in to make sure that, you know, I was the funny overweight girl who just loved making everyone laugh. So I felt like that was my work, right? I got to go here. I got to get everybody hyped for the game. Let's do this. And also school. Like I loved writing my poems and reading them to my family when I got home and doing all like, that was like my work. Like I loved school. Like I loved making the teachers love me. Like that was something I took super seriously. But when I was in it, it was just like my everyday. And now you look back and you're like, all the work you did. We also always mess with my mom. Because we always had a chore list on the calendar for every week, and she would rotate us for washing, drying, putting away dishes. Mm-hmm. But my brother never was on the list. Like he would mow the lawn, but we're like, Mom, what? And she's like, this is like women empowerment. I was like,
just general, like in the chore. But were you on the mowing lawn list?
No. What is this shit?
That would be interesting.
Yep. We're like, you're so lucky you have some strong daughters because this is messed up.
Yeah. Man. Poems. Do you still write poems? Do you still write poetry?
I mean haikus. I mean, they'd be about donuts and stuff, but they were real good.
Do you remember any?
I actually made a song for the restaurant I worked at. It's really good. Do you want to hear it?
Oh, of course.
Welcome to Capona's. How many would you like to see? Oh, this is when smoking was there. Smoking preference, booth or table. You're welcome. I made that.
That's awesome.
We also sing sentences in my house. It's just important. You don't have to have a good voice. You should just always sing something.
I like it. What's the... So was it Capona's? Is that what you said?
Yeah, Capona's Dugout. It's right here in Clearwater.
Okay.
Italian
restaurant. Uh-oh.
Friend of the family, but my sister manages it.
Now?
Mm-hmm.
Is this now? Okay, hold on.
Friend
this
is not. Been in the family for like 25 years.
When you said my mom and sister worked at a place and I started busting, this is the same place. Really?
We keep it real close family.
Now, is this your family that owns this?
No, it's friends of the family. I mean, they're like family now.
That's,
I mean,
awesome.
My sister manages it, so she's basically a Capona. But I moved to Miami for 7 years and came back, and we live super close to the restaurant.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Are you Italian?
Lebanese.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, my mom and dad are both Lebanese, but it was my great grandparents that came from Lebanon.
Nice.
Everybody's in Buffalo, New York.
Were they just in a Lebanese community? Is that how they got to know each other?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this might be disgusting for some people, but we're like, you guys have a cousin you share somewhere. Because we always make fun of our great-great-great-parents like, met in a village. And I always said in high school, I had a presentation and the teacher was like, that's inappropriate. I said, our family tree, I'm not sure if it has branches. It just goes straight up. So I was like you met because our grandfathers were friends and they met. At like a family reunion, and it just doesn't sound right.
We met at our family reunion.
You guys,
so I'm curious, back to your children. I know they're quite young still, but let's say fast forward 30 years and I sit down with them and I say, can you tell me about your earliest memories of work or what work meant when it took on meaning in your life? Do you have any idea of what you might anticipate? Maybe the oldest, because they're only 7'5". I get like that we're too young here. So maybe what he might say, because he probably already has something shaping. Your 5-year-old may also. I doubt your 1-year-old has any concept of anything. but like, so what they might say based on something like temperament, things you've seen, or then what you're hoping to instill, because I'm interested in the idea of like working, the work of parenting and the instilling of something along the value of work and work ethic and what those things mean.
Yeah. So I think they also kind of incorporated the job, but I hope, because we do things for nonprofits around here. So like they came with me to deliver presents for a homeless empowerment program down the street, for the kids for Christmas who don't have any toys. And then we did foster children up in Lutz for fostering change, foster closet. So that I hope is what I'm instilling in them. And this is our work. Like this is what we should do. But I do know sometimes Jaden will ask my sister and be like, hey, when do I get to work here at the restaurant and stuff? Like I know that work for him a little bit is a job probably. But there's days where he's like, oh, I hate doing these chores. And some days where he just goes and helps. So I hope I'm instilling the help people mentality. That's all you can really hope. It's just good human is really my goal for them, is just be a good human.
That's right.
Let people be happy who are good people and just be human.
Do you, curious about observing them, is, do you have any, I mean, maybe your oldest at this point, I'm still quite young, but like any inclination on, cause I know like, so like taking the concept of vocation, right? And I actually think sometimes in children, you can kind of tell like what they might not be, what they might be. Yeah. Like, it's not like you know, but you can kind of see the raw material of things. I'm curious if you have any insights on.
So I know my son who loves building, he's dyslexic and he is just Mr. Builder, right? He loves the hands-on stuff. I think he'll, I don't know, he loves Legos and all that stuff. And he just loves creating things, right? I don't know what he's going to do, but he has an amazing heart. Like he is sweet Jaden, no confrontation. Like he is that. Juliana, she is a strong little girl and she is so empowering already. I love, one time she whispered in her sister's ear that she was brave when she was crying and just like to stop her from, she's like, you're brave, you're gonna be okay, you're brave. And I was just like, so that's she awesome. Might, I don't know, she might run the country. I don't know what she'll do. She intimidates me and makes me a better woman all at once. And her brother will be right by her side. But there are times you can tell, he's just like, oh, sometimes just so overpowering. Like just, and he's so non-confrontational where he's just like, I would like to play by myself right now. Like, let me go do my own Legos. But she is always in it. She's like, no, you're gonna play with me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, are it's fun. I don't know what they'll be like. And sure, I want them to sure. be as long as they are happy.
That's right.
Just like, I am so excited to see, but I love the age they're at because they're just like observing everything and absorbing everything.
But even are you familiar with any personality typologies? Are you like whether the Enneagram or Myers-Briggs or any of those things? None of those. You're okay. Because what you as you and that's fine. But as you like,
no, I know flesh those them, out. I just,
and I don't know, but like even at the basic, like as you just talk about them, it's like, hey, I want to go build on my own. Like there's, you go, oh, well, we have the introvert extrovert breakdown. No, we're going to be together. No, I'm going to go over here. You, as you tell a story, you're like, I was in hospitality, I was with people. I just want to be with people. I want to interview people. I want to talk to people. Like there's like, there's something going, you know what I mean? Like there's the, those kind of temperaments, strong and empowering. Like those are, or the one that would whisper to the crying individual you're brave is there's a typology called the Enneagram, which I'm real familiar with, and in that this is like these 9 numbers, but one of them is an 8, and an 8 is really power oriented in the way they see the world and tend to be really strong, boisterous personalities, just like a force of nature in a lot of ways. but also really mindful of underdogs. So it's related, power dynamics and underdogs. And when you said that little vignette, I'm like, oh man, I wonder if she's an eight. But like, just, I'm always like fascinated with these typologies. And I think they play a lot into us exploring, you know, like almost like the idea that you're made for something. Right. And just, it's right. Yeah. We want you to do whatever you want to do, whatever you're not what I want for you, what you're created for maybe, but then watching and learning and seeing like what flames you can fan, like, oh, I'm a builder, you know, as a builder and creative. It's like, you know, I know growing up, I was, I was artistic, very much a creator, creative. I was like, I'm going to be an artist. And my dad would be like, that's not an option. That's not a real job. You can't be an artist, which eventually I concluded on my own as well. I was like, yeah, that starving artist thing is quite real, but it was a deep kind of felt like a real calling at some level too, you know, something that I was really passionate about, but then also like, and actually I would say even the work I'm in now, I've come to see as a bit of like my art has changed. I see it a little bit as a performance art, this kind of like trying to demonstrate a different kind of world in the work that we do or something like that. Okay. I know we're meandering all over the place here, but this is so good. There's so many things. So what do I want to come around to here? Let's see. So are there any in your own podcasting experience? So you're meeting people, talking to people. You kind of have this very broad, like, which I appreciate because I do too. I'm like, yeah, I want to talk to everybody about work and what they're working on and what's a relationship with work like or whatever. So you have like ordinary people kind of living extraordinary lives in some capacity. So I'm curious, like as you think over 86 interviews or whatever it is, like are there things that you have found that you're like, if I were to say like, man, there's themes that are emerging. There's things that like here's like the takeaways of the meta story of these things. I'm curious, like what you've observed and learned through that experience.
I think the vulnerability of people, just change. Some people, the first time they told their story, and you just see this like weight lift off of them. Like that shame they were living in, or that, you know, that scare, fear of people judging them, and they're on a podcast. You really don't have to worry about an audience. You're telling your story for the first time, and I don't edit. They come at me and like, I need this out of there.
Please take out what I said about grandma. I've had a few of those. I'm like, all right,
I mean, they're like, I'm not gonna be like, no, I can't edit, but I do it so it's just like a free flowing, authentic conversation. Yep. But also because I'm learning so much, because the shame that we live in for stories, or that just how we feel judged all the time, just watching people share their story for the first time is just so uplifting to me, and seeing the perseverance of people. So the attitude they have towards an obstacle or something they have been able to overcome, or what they do every day, like making sure people know this isn't easy. Is one of my, I'm always like, what gets you going on those rough days, or what does this? And it's fun to hear, music is such a big thing, right? People's the music choices, or, you know, what gets you, and me, 100% music. I will repeat a song all the way to work if I'm having a bad day. And that song will be like 9 times. But if
what's the song?
Oh no, I just song,
what's the,
one.
Do you, what's I, the most recent song you've had on repeat?
Sunday's Best.
Sunday's Best.
Really good. Super chill. But I also like Gotta Live from Tadashi is a really good one. And there's just all these ones that I have repeated before. And it's fun because the kids get into things like that.
Especially if it's on repeat.
They're not in the car on my way to work. They're like, okay, mom. They actually repeat it now too. But music is really big for people, and just their support system. And for me, I think people can really get through anything when there's a sense of community. And it's really hard when you hear those stories of just like, I was alone And I couldn't, you know, because it's like, oh, where was that one person to just, even if you didn't, it didn't resonate with you at the time, you can look back and be like, that person was there. But community and connection is just such a huge, just a huge factor in people's success, like just for themselves, like not successful as in money, but successful just to feel good. So I love hearing stories and I love learning about people. So it's fun that like, sometimes I want to ask you a question, but I'm like, no, this is his podcast.
Feel free.
No, I mean like about your life. We'll get into that.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's really uplifting. And after a podcast day, cause I do recordings like six at once, it's exhausting. Cause like by the end, I'm like, can I even complete a sentence? But it's a weird energy I get. Really like hyped at the end. Like I used to at the casino because there'd be oxygen in there. I'd be super awake the whole shift. And then I walk out. I'm like, I'm going to pass out. Like I'm going to go, it was overnight in college. So I would be like, I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to pass out. But that's how I feel. I feel rejuvenated after a podcast because just passionate people.
It has been a really, I haven't done full days like that. I haven't cranked them out throughout the day. Although I think that's pretty smart though, because you can kind of click into a frame of mind, do that all day and you're good for the next month of releasing them or whatever.
And if I kept leaving like all through the week, the kids would be like, hey, why do you keep leaving the house? I like to just be like, I have a podcast day and I've interviewed them. They're like 5-minute episodes.
Nice.
But it was a funny day. It's funny because kids cling to like their idea that day. So mm-hmm. like you can't get any other answers but like what they were doing.
What I'm thinking about. That's awesome. There was a couple things you said as you were kind of going through that, and I want to kind of like explore them a little bit. So you said like one thing was like people as they tell their stories, you often see that they face some sort of an obstacle. So like in your own story, even you're like, we had this obstacle with fertility, or we had this, you know, I had the obstacle of being in jail. You have these things that emerge and you're like there. And so you use the phrase like an attitude toward an obstacle. And it's interesting at some basic level, some very, very basic level. I'm like, obstacles are irritating at the very least, right? This thing is in my way and I'm trying to go there, whatever it is. And then how they overcome obstacles. And I'm like, I feel like that sentence is very much related to something like the theme of this show, in a sense of like much of what work is kind of like sacrificing something today to have something better for tomorrow, like investing in something that's hard now for something that's good later. And a lot of times those are about things that stand in our way. We have to, when you find an obstacle, you have to work. That's when work becomes like, it's either despair or work, right? So I'm curious, I'd love to just hear you kind of like muse on the concept of obstacle and attitude around that.
When you brought up the work thing, you know how like you have those people that go into work and they just have to bring the whole atmosphere down with them because they're in something that happened on the way. Mm-hmm. I used to run like a floor of 40 reps. So the levels of attitude definitely vary, but like the obstacles you can tell, like for me in the very beginning, when I got arrested, that obstacle was shameful. I had to go into interviews and I was like, well, I have a record. I have a recent, you know, but as I progressed as a human and grew from that experience, the attitude towards it is okay. I'm an ex-felon. Like this is part of me. I've learned from it. I've grown from it. And my attitude completely shifted to not like shameful. So when you have these people talk about an obstacle they've overcome, there's actually like a light that comes out from them. And it's just like talking about it and being able to say it, because everybody's going to face something at a different level. Right. And it really is. Everybody does face it. And how you take, how your attitude is towards it and how you're able to grow from it and how you're able to experience it is really how life's going to end up. And I guess I'm blessed to have people I've interviewed who talk about an obstacle, but how they've overcome it or what they've grown from. But it's sometimes sad because you're like, wow, that's a lot for someone to carry. But I think with the work thing, we sometimes people hate their job so much that work turns into this obstacle for just enjoying anything. Mm-hmm. And that really, that sucks. And it's sad because I've been in that mode and I've had to like knock myself out of it. Cause I'm just like, oh my gosh, these meetings are horrible. Oh my gosh, this day is going to be horrible. But like we've treated work like that, where you're telling people like live out your purpose, but really it's just go to a job that doesn't destroy the rest of your day. Right. Then the purpose is there. If you're helping someone and that's your purpose, then do that. Like, it's just people, it's really hard. It's being just self-aware.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, I mean, that really is at the heart of like, so this conversation for me got, the reason this show emerged was just, I just realized I was like really fascinated with the concept of work and our relationship to it. And I think I was kind of irritated with the idea that it's, we only talk about jobs. So like, oh, I've told this on here plenty of times, but not to you necessarily. So like, you know, I work with a lot of folks that are on the streets and therefore not therefore, but in many cases, unemployed, most cases unemployed. I work with a lot of people that are unemployed and yet I'm like, you need to work. I'm like, well, no one's hiring. It's like, that's not what I'm talking about. Like we can go work in the garden. You can like do something like you need to work on something. You need to have a goal, pick up something heavy, do something hard and feel a sense of accomplishment. So we can go dig a hole. We can landscape this place. We can grow some food in the garden. If you don't have food, we can work on this bike together. Because I just deeply believe, I believe that we need to work in the same way we need to eat and we need community. Like you mentioned that, like connection and community, these are like mm-hmm. among the basic necessities. And then related to that is, that's something I want to really explore. But then I also see with the technology and the way it's going, it's like a lot of our work, job work is going to go away. Like the drivers, that's going to be a wrap. The cashiers, that's going to be a wrap. The, you know, I mean, God, I'm seeing these these kitchen robots now that I'm like, oh, that's just a matter of time. The burger mm-hmm. flippers, that's going to be done away with. Yeah. And honestly, I'm not like, I don't want to be Luddite like against that. I'm like, no, it's going to be way more efficient. But what's that going to mean for us? Because I know people that don't have employment and I know how hard it is for us to change the way we frame these things and how important it is. And then what you just brought up to put alongside this is, then I hear people say work is soul sucking, where I'm like, whoa, work is a source of life actually. So that's, I'm confused. And then I'm like, oh, you mean your job, because it's out of alignment with something that is meaningful to you. That's purpose, community, those kind of things. And I fully recognize, especially among materially poor people, like sometimes it's just toil because I just need a paycheck because I got these kids I got to feed. I don't have the luxury of a calling at this point or something like that. And I'm aware of that. And I don't want to discredit that. But at the same time, I'm deeply troubled by some of the ways that we discuss work and God, working next to that person that is like, this is just a soul sucking place. It's like, well, then do all of us have to get that life sucked out of us because of that? Right.
Is that all of us have to do that? And you're right with saying the word job and work, it is different.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it interchangeably, which it shouldn't be.
We all do.
Job is operations at a marketing company, but my work is to understand people, you know, see what really drives them, understand who they are. And educate too along the way, right? Sometimes people just haven't opened their mind for certain things. Because a perfect example, just, you know, LGBTQ community. My dad is an older man, but like just understanding that people have loved ones that are close to them. Like you just don't say hurtful things. Or when I've told people I'm a felon, they're like, you don't look like one. I'm like, what does one look like? Mm-hmm. Like, what does one look like? Like, that is the most stereotypical thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I look, I don't look that different than Martha Stewart or
whatever. Yeah, like, thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I would love to be friends with Snoop Dogg. But like,
I'm so jealous of our relationship.
Thank you. But it's just like, it's just educating people. And my husband always says I get hype over things. I don't get hype. I'm just super passionate about people. Mm-hmm. being able to be who they are and other people helping. Like when people just like walk away from someone, I've wanted to like stop the car and help someone cross a road. And my son goes, well, next time just stay at the red light and let's do it, you know? And I was like, you're right. Cause you could just see the, it was like an older man holding a bag. And I was like, someone needs to help him cross the road, but I got two kids in the car. But like, there's like little things that just I get hype about because I just, I think it's effort. Instead of putting effort into being mad at everybody, like put a little effort into just helping that one person. Mm-hmm. It would take a lot of effort, like a lot of effort.
Well, and beyond just the other person, like the thing, the framework you just use is like, instead of, I mean, to me, this is a core conviction. Instead of being mad, take responsibility. So at some basic level, I'm like, I don't want to live in a world where people sleep in alleys that reek of urine and hope a church guy comes by with a meal of sucky food or something, right? I don't want to live in that world, but I do. So I'm either like, well, I don't like the idea of suicide either. So what's your alternative is like to do something about it and go, you know what? In as long as I live in a world where that's happening, I need to take responsibility for my neighbors that are in need or my community or my city, right? And it is, to me, that's good medicine because it's on my shoulder. I could do something about that. Yeah. Whereas like it just shaking my fist at the world, leads to frustration and despair and resentment in so many cases. And I know for me, that's a temptation at times. And it's like, that's the choice, right? Yep. So you're like, I could be mad about this or I could pull off the road and somebody should do something. It's like, oh yeah, that's exactly. That's an interesting.
And my 7-year-old woke me up and I was like,
so good.
But it's good too, because you know, like you have those aha moments where you're just like, okay, like what's next? Like, just do it. Like what's stopping us is the society, the words, like just things that shouldn't be influencing us. But it takes effort on both ends. Is, you know, you can sit here and complain about it, that's going to take effort, or you can actually do something about it. You know, it's a work in progress every day, and you have to know that you can improve every day. I think the people with the huge egos are just so hard to get through to. Like, I don't do anything wrong, I'm just helping everybody, I donated this much today. It's like, okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, so we talked about obstacles and overcoming obstacles and the work of that. But then you said, well, you can get through anything if you have a sense of community and connection. And so I just wanted to circle back to that and go on.
Yeah. I do feel like, I think a good example, it hurts my heart sometimes, but when my mom went through, my mom and dad's divorce, my dad coming out, you know, it was a blindsided moment for her, but she didn't have, we were in the Catholic Church. I love God. We have a very good relationship, but the Catholic Church has a way of judging and pushing people out.
Sure.
This like shunned my mom because of divorce. And then, I was super young. I was in 7th grade.
Okay.
So watching her family not being supportive, her being by herself, it was a very hard time for her. And looking back now, I'm like, I really wish you had a group of people around you that helped you through it and didn't shame you for someone else's, you know, life and that living authentically. Like they really like, you know, put on my mom. Where when I went through what I did with my husband 3 years ago, his recovery, all these lies that I found out about, I had a very strong power source around me that was like, you can leave him, we'll have your back. If you want to support him, we'll have your back. You know, I let him recover, because I knew the kids needed a great dad. I wasn't thinking anything for myself right now. I know he's a good human. He's an amazing human. But he was going through something and it wasn't about me. So right. I had a very strong backing of family and friends around me. And that sense of community didn't bring all the shame on me, which it could have been. And that connection was just so important to know that I had that if I needed it. No one came up to me and like felt sorry for me and asked me questions. They wouldn't like dig in like things like that, but I knew they were there. Like it was just a simple, we're here. You let me know, where I can see the difference of that, like falling apart to having a net underneath you. And it's just, I feel that community is very important. I feel the support we showed my husband helped get him through everything he was going through. I think that I always want my kids to know whatever decisions you make, although I might be like, really, you always have that support, that sense of just non-judgment support. Was like, I was on this whole kick of like, no judgment here. I'm definitely not a relationship advice person, but like, you know, I was blindsided. My mom was blindsided, totally different things, but like,
yeah. Oh, interesting.
Getting hit with that and having to like look internally and not blame yourself and stuff, and to have people remind you it's not on you is hard, but she didn't have that. Yeah. And that was even harder. And for me, I'm always like, I'm sorry we were so young that we couldn't give you that support, because I know what it does to people. It elevates you, it levels you up, it helps you become more self-aware. And you just want to be a better person when you know you have like a support around you.
It's interesting thinking about the word encouragement, you know, as like to give courage. Like when you're in a place that you really need courage, encouragement of a friend, even the presence of a friend is encouraging, right? I'm not here alone. I'm not the only one. And this is the beauty of people sharing their stories in forms like this as well. It's like they're, oh, I can gain access to someone who's walked this road, gone through these things. I'm curious. So one of the, there haven't been a lot of opportunities for this, and you may or may not be an opportunity for this, but like with that experience with your husband and recovery, the work of recovery is something that I'm really interested in. I mean, I'm very familiar with the 12 steps. I'm a huge fan of 12 steps. I actually, because of a similar situation, to you historically, was in a close relationship with an addict. And so then I got into 12 steps because of that, not because of an addiction per se, but because of proximity. So that's why you have things like, what do they call Al-Anon, and there's a bunch of different versions, but like because it's like, there's almost like the sickness rubs off in some sense. Like I'm going to go crazy dealing with this craziness. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious if you took advantage of any of those kind of communities or tools, and then just like, I'd love to hear you kind of reflect on this through the lens of something that you had to work through.
Oh yeah. So I, found out my husband had lied for about 7 years on porn addiction, sex addiction, and cocaine. It was a blindsided moment for me. But recovery was different too. I went to therapy instead of Al-Anon. I looked into it. How do I say it?
Yeah, that's right. Al-Anon.
Because I felt this wasn't my recovery.
Yep. Right.
And at first it was very much like, what are you doing? What did you do? I didn't know about anything. And that was one thing I had to understand in myself. And we really, our kids were much younger than they are. The third one was not here. I said, this isn't my family's decision. Take care of these kids. If this is a serious change for you. He's told his truth to my whole family, which is, my family's a little intimidating. So he did that to start his recovery. And we acted as roommates. So the kids and I slept in one room. We were in an apartment at the time because we were building a house. And I allowed him to recover, but while being with the kids, because I work out early, like it's not their job to wake up early and come to my house. Like, these are your children. If this is recovery for you, then we can do this. But I never thought we would be where we are today. Like, I could not, during that time of hurt and betrayal and all of these things, I thought I lived this wonderful life with my husband. I would never thought we'd be here today. I just wanted to help him get through recovery because I thought my kids deserved that.
Sure. Yep.
And recovery for him, I know we do therapy still. I think therapy for everyone, even if something bad doesn't happen. I think it's such an important thing to have someone there, because she puts me in my place sometimes, because I do jabs. I get jabs up. But like, he one time said, I know you have one foot out the door, but being a good human and not lying is just such a different feeling. Mm-hmm. Like, I know who I want to be now. I know who my daughter should look up to. Like, I know who my son should look up to. Like, once he said that, it was like a weight had been lifted off my shoulder, knowing that recovery is working. Like, knowing that you can see that it takes work. Mm-hmm. Society definitely has a huge influence on addict. There are so many addictions out there, right? There are so many.
That's right.
You can be a liar. You can be like, there's just so many. And you try to get other addictions to hide another addiction and then another addiction. And it's just like this, and it takes a lot of work. But once he said that, I knew the work is being done every day. We live in a society where like all these urges are everywhere all the time, right? Like everywhere all the time. But it's as long as we know we're doing the work and, you know, we just started connecting again and we had the kit and, you know, I just took one day at a time and I still do.
Yeah.
It just takes the one time I shared my story in front of a group of 300 women and I told the whole story and you just had women come up to you at the end and was like, you know, I was a part, like my husband had this addiction and you could tell like they were able to take that shame away because infidelity, first of all, nobody wants to talk about.
Right.
But sitting there as a woman who would be like, leave him. And, you know, no girl, you don't need that my whole life, but I'm sitting here because there is a person inside. And don't get me wrong. If he sat there and was like, well, it is what it is. Really? I mean, I wouldn't be here today. I would not be married, but he did the work and we all have our vices. And if my parents never said you're going to change out of jail, like I'd be alone by myself. And I don't feel that you should give up on someone who wants to do the work.
I love that. I mean, and just from knowing both in my own experience with going through 12-step stuff, but then also just, I have a friend that runs a recovery program with some sober houses. And I mean, to be honest, like there are some of these addicts that are like, you know, almost they become some of the wisest people I've ever met. And some of them are just like, just straight redneck or whatever. I mean, like they're not like educated people. And this isn't true. Some are extremely educated, right?
But like, ordinary
but
people.
Like you meet these people and you're like, you know, this guy has very low education, whatever it is, but yet has something like some kind of a wisdom that emerges out of a life because of that struggle, which, and in my mind, I've always contrasted 12-step meetings with going to church. Cause I'm spiritual person. I believe in community. I want to follow Jesus, but I've always struggled with going to church, like for a few different reasons.
Physically going.
Like I don't want to sing these stupid songs and like, I don't, there's a lot of it. I don't like,
well,
I
church
just,
is where you are. What? Church is where your heart. Church should be where you are. I'm so with you with that. I'm so with you with the man-made church that we don't have to be there to do church. And I'll tell you what, my husband's recovery was a lot on prayer.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Well, and he says he would pray a lot. Like,
I mean, that's a huge part of the, like developing a conscious contact with God and a regular discipline of prayer, meditation. But you know, what's interesting actually, what you're saying about the church, like we use the word to talk about like a building or a place you go or an activity we do, rather than us together as the people of God doing whatever it is that we're doing. And I've always, and you know, I think like, well, that's an unfortunate, I think, you know, a good illustration of that is a school and a school. So you have like a school building institution and a school of fish, a collective, right? And that school, it's like those, but we use the same word, but if I use it and you don't know what I'm talking about, it's like, it's unfortunate that it's the same word. And this is actually an interesting overlap with the way we're using work. Like one of the things I'm like, I'm trying to like piece apart
work
and go
and
like
job,
work and job, vocation, call, you know, all of these kind of things are like really trying to pull apart. Like, what are we actually talking about here? But actually what I mean by the gathering in the church building of the church, the people of God, I have a struggle with those things. And sometimes it's just like, cause of my temperament. And I think these are silly sing-alongs and whatever. And then some of it is critique of institutional church, like the waste of money, the neglect of the poor. Why is it all white people here or black people here? Like, why are we so segregated? There's a million questions I have about the institutions that we call churches. But yeah. The thing I was getting at was when I went in a 12-step meeting versus a church, because a lot of times 12-step meetings are in churches, the buildings, right? Yeah, like, because they say, oh, you can use these buildings. Like when we're not using them, because they don't use them all week long, it seems. So 12-step meetings will meet there. And then what's interesting to me is I personally, when I sit in those two meetings, I go, the meeting where I would say the Spirit of God is palpably present is in the room where a bunch of people came in and said, I have a problem and I'm fucking up and here's my story. And they share in vulnerability. Whereas the other one goes, everything's great. I got it together. I'm in my Sunday best. And I go, God isn't here. Well, at least it seems right. Like in that, the contrast, I've been in the same building, some of the same people even. And I've been like, God like left the building after the 12-step meeting in some really profound way. And when I meet some of these raggedy addicts that have spent their whole life, like, you know, shooting heroin or whatever. And I'm like, how did this guy become a sage, like a holy man? Mm-hmm. And in so many ways, I'm like, because he went to hell, actually, because he said, there's something wrong with me. And somehow healing emerges out of brokenness and identification of those things, that it's profound. And you know, your husband doing that work, it's like, at some level, you may have the best version of what, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's, and what a prize on the other side of that struggle.
It really is the real, you're right. I never really put it like that, but that side of church, it's like the fakeness and realness. Like, here I am, here's all of me, accept me here. Here's my flaws. I mean, the chips are powerful. He's in a group of men and they get a chip.
Yep.
And that is like, way to go. The encouragement, you know, the everything in there is, that's powerful. And then you go to church the next day and everyone's singing these hymns and then it's like, this isn't real. But what is real is what was there earlier, because that's where the Spirit of God lays for me, is in your, the most authentic spot in your life with zero judgment. And I don't know who is interpreting the Bible, but that Jesus was brown and he was definitely accepting everyone for everything as long as you had good character. So that's like something I always say, and it's really, and my son's in a Christian school right now, so we go through the Bible stories. And I remember Catholic school, I would always raise my hand and be like, okay, I heard that, but also what about, and they'd be like, oh, you're wrong, you know, and I'm like, I understand that, you know. And I always want him to question that, because what's in your heart is the most important. And you know, you're a good human. Like, the shame around addiction is so unfortunate. And again, you get the, oh, he doesn't look like a recovering addict. Like, what do they look like? Because I know from high-end lawyers to, you know, like someone who just lost their job, like they range from every person. And it's just crazy to me that people are just, society has put these like little faces on things. Like, just, nope, this is what this looks like. Nope. Well, that's a homeless person. No, that can't be homeless. They're dressed well. Like, what? Why are they not to take a shower when someone offers them a shower? Like, why are they not? Like, it's just another.
And I will tell you, just, and for those listening, like, I, what ended up happening was, and it was related to some, the relational struggle. And I wasn't crazy about like the Al-Anon version of that. It was so specifically like alcoholic spouses and husbands and parents and whatever. Yeah. But I found this, there's a group called CODA. That's a 12-step meeting for, it's Codependence Anonymous is what it is.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it because at some basic level, they're like, well, you know, what you need, you know, in many of them, it's like, you need to identify like that alcohol has a power over you, or that, you know, you need help, or heroin or drug, whatever the addiction is. But in the CODA meetings, it's just healthy relationships. So to go, I don't have control over my relationships. And I'm like, oh my God, what an accessible version of this. And it's the same 12 steps.
Yep.
It's like, what about my relationship with everything? My relationship with my the people in my life, my relationship with my work, my relationship with working out, my relationship with food, my relationship with all of these things. And so that's where I really settled in. And what I found, and I went for years in those meetings regularly, I was in love with them. And I started realizing like, this was like a place that the addicts would graduate to. So they'd be like, yeah, I mean, I was in NA for forever, but eventually like I'm good. Like I'm mentoring and sponsoring younger people. And I've been sober for 20 years and whatever. And my sponsor said, you know, why don't you move over to CODA now where you could start just addressing the relationships in your life. And just like you said earlier, like, I think everyone should be in therapy. So here's my little poor man's, I'm 100% in agreement with that. I also can't afford it. And many of the people in my life can't afford it. Now I do know of some crisis situation. Like you can get some free counseling from this pastor or whatever. And there are some of those things, but for ongoing, just basic kind of, I found that I'm like, well, yeah, but at CODA, it's not exactly a therapist, but is it therapeutic? And you could just throw a dollar in the hat when they pass it, you know, like it's, and you don't even really need to do that, which is where I probably would say I ended up there because it was accessible in that same sense.
And I really like the fact of, I think we have relationships to heal across the board.
That's right.
With everything.
Everything.
And that is such a, I don't know why I was never told about CODA. But again, I let his recovery be his recovery. So when I looked into it, the basis of that for me, you're right, it was very alcohol focused. And I think it should just be addiction focused in general. And I love that about CODA. And that it's accessible for everyone. And you're 100% right. Not everybody has insurance. Not everybody can get to where they need to. I know that when I was put into counseling after I was arrested, we did the services that were given to us for counseling. It wasn't a registered therapist or this, it was just someone to talk to. But that's where community comes in, right? CODA made a community of people, and when people can help, they can help. They throw a dollar in, a couple dollars.
Yep.
And they can't. And that is so important, you know. And I met a woman who lost her husband from an overdose and is now opening something that focuses on family support because she didn't feel her and her kids got enough to help him through recovery and also get themselves. So she wants to have access to have therapy or counseling or people who can babysit or things like that for those families, because she actually, he passed away from overdose. So like she was in it and she's still recovering, but during her recovery and you know, grief, she is trying to facilitate something so it doesn't happen like that again. And that, I think that's really important. And it's super sad to think, you know, you had to lose someone to help other people like this, but addiction is just such a shameful thing people talk about and discuss, and it's hard for people to share it, but it really is, everyone has an addiction.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's what I was kind of trying to get at. Even like, I'm like, everyone needs to go to CODA, because I promise you, you might not be shooting heroin, but your relationship with your work, your relationship with the gym, your relationship with those cookies.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you, I still will have a stressful day and eat like a rack of cookies. And I know that's bad. Like it's just some, you know, like it's your, that's why I think, again, people don't talk about like CODA. I wouldn't have known about it unless someone told me.
Well, I try to like echo it a lot because I just happened upon it and I was so grateful for it. And I was like, man, people need to know about this. But at the same time, yeah, you're right. It's like, and by the way, even like, I know that's bad. Like at some level, healthy and unhealthy or wise and unwise is a helpful lens to go like, yeah, I'm in a cookie or two, whatever, you know, but like we just try to like navigate. I mean, we are all navigating really complex relationships and situations, but the reality is we all have. And so for me, this is actually maybe at the heart of my, you know, so a lot of, you'll hear me when you hear me talk about the people that I work with, you'll hear me say a lot of times, like the materially poor. And I do that really intentionally because I don't think it's just about possessions. Right. So like, there's people with all kinds of material possessions that are extremely poor people. They're socially poor. They're psychologically poor. They're spiritually poor. Like, there's all of these ways. And what I mean when I say that, what I mean is, and because I think addiction, I would camp in under poverty, because I would say poverty is a lack of freedom. So anywhere that you're not free, you experience poverty. Now, we usually think of that in terms of like, I'm not free to sleep where I want, eat what I want, go where I want, material poverty in that sense. But also, like, just take social isolation and go, I'm not, like you said, people that have community and connection can get through anything. What about the isolated? Isn't that a kind of social poverty, right? Yeah. That we should, and to me, I go, well, that's really helpful to me for a couple of reasons. But one is something like solidarity, because, or understanding or compassion, because I'm not like temperamentally a very compassionate person. I'm philosophically compassionate, I would say. But like, the reason for that is I go, well, I've grown to know my own poverty. I've grown to know where I'm not in control. I'm not free. I'm not fully free to express what I want to express, for whatever the reason may be. And I want to grow in freedom, in my own capacity to kind of express those things. And so then when you see like, hey, I'm not free to not use cocaine, or I'm not free to get out of this relationship, or I'm not free to leave this job. It's like, or I'm not free to both feed my kid and get the prenatal medication that I need for the kid that I'm pregnant with. It's like, those aren't real choices. That's just poverty. And all of those are. And for me, it's helpful because, like you said, there's so much shame and stigma around being poor or being an addict or being a felon, or, you know, it's like all these things we stigmatize, but at some level, and I'm hoping we can, I've never put these words together, but normalize poverty in some sense, like where we go, no, like, we're human beings. We all experience poverty. This is not hard for you to understand. Like, you do know poverty intimately.
Yeah.
That's every obstacle you face, everything that stands in your way, everything that takes away your ability to choose where you go, who you go mm-hmm. with, how you go. And those are things that, anyway, just kind of like reflecting on that. And I go, man, it's really helpful for us, because then we go, well, hopefully, it doesn't have to be something to be filled with shame. I mean, we're all going to deal with shame. It's something we allow to take place in our own hearts and minds. So, okay, back to this. I'm still kind of going up that first, you said, okay, talking to all these people, there's these themes that are emerging, their attitude toward obstacles, overcoming obstacles, but I think they can get through anything with a sense of community and connection. And then you said something like, that's a huge factor in terms of people's success. And you're like, but I don't mean success in this monetary wealth way. So I was like, oh, I have to circle back to that, because one of the questions I ask every single person I talk to is, so how do you define success?
For me now as a mom, I will definitely take into account how I raise my kids as successful. But mine is just impacting people's lives. That's how I, by giving the person an opportunity to share who they are, by giving them a welcoming feel when they speak. I think success for me is just making people feel good for who they are, who they decided to be because they are that person. But I think in a world full of judgment and hate, it's really important for me to make sure I always have that bubble of welcoming and open-mindedness and education. I'm always up for a nice educational lesson that opens my mind a little bit further. Mm-hmm. But that's success now for me. Now, if you asked me that when I was 21, I was like, money.
Stacks. That was fat stacks.
But it's crazy that, you know, people are like, oh, so talk about the seasons you're in, but you are when you're in a season for yourself. So I do take, my prayers were answered when my husband had to reveal everything. Cause I was like, something's off. My gut tells me my prayers were answered. So when that happened, I was like, you know what? I put myself on hold for a long time. Let's get back to who I wanted to be. That's when the podcast happened. That's when I went off on my own and consulting, you know, it was a rebirth for me as well. So I didn't take it as full heartbreak, even though I was picking up the pieces as I go. I do see it as an eye-opening to remember that you are number one, and the person you should love the most is yourself. I know that getting back to like working out and stuff for my kids' health was important, because again, you can't pour from an empty glass. If I'm not doing anything for myself, like how am I supposed to help you? And I'm human too, so I'll tell them I'm sorry a lot. If I do something, like if I yell, or if I, you know, I'm like, I'm sorry I yelled, but I really appreciate you talking to me like that. Thank you. I don't treat them like, oh, let's talk this out. You're seven. But it's more like when I know I've gone, like, you know, I come from a loud family, very big family. And, you know, there's just, it's just, if people could take more accountability and just learn as we go, I feel like life would just be a little bit more easier for people. I don't really care about other people's opinions anymore.
I love it. So there's a theme you were kind of, and you kind of hit on this just now, but it just made me realize, as you talked about like putting the pieces back together and things like falling apart and then putting them back together. And I just thought back over probably the news of infertility, the news of your husband's addiction, possibly your arrest. I'm sure there's a couple other stories, but the word that comes to mind is disoriented. So, and this is actually related. So I'll go ahead, and on your LinkedIn profile in the bio area, it says, I'm a vision oriented leader. So I would like to circle back to that, but not right now, but the idea of orientation is what stood out to me. So you're like, I'm oriented toward a vision, and I'm getting a feel for what I think that might be. Right. But in those moments, there's an experience of disorientation. Like it makes me think of like when I used to surf and get washed, like I don't know which way is up. Right. And I know we all share those experiences. So where do you talk to me about like the experience of not knowing which way is up, or those moments of disorientation, and how you've seen yourself orient?
Like back on track.
Yeah. But not even like get back on track. Just flesh out the experience of being lost or being disoriented. Like, so then there's work to be done of back on track, assuming you found the track.
Yeah. I hate saying back on track, because what's on track?
Sure.
You're right. And so for me, I mean, experience from all these little things that have happened. And yeah,
they're
smile,
all very little, like, quite small.
Yeah. So small. but I think also, for my dad coming out in seventh grade, it was very disorienting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I didn't know, we're a very close family. So it was like, what does it look like now? From that experience, I think helped mold me to realize like things that society characterizes as absolutely catastrophic can be handled.
Yeah.
So infertility. Oh yeah. That was like an emotional roller coaster when a doctor has like no personality and tells you this is why you can't get pregnant. Your fallopian tube is a block, blah, 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 we got to remove them, whatever. That was like, where do I go from here? This is one of the things I wanted to do. And another thing that helped me realize, like, there's no milestone for you to hit. You don't get married, you don't date, get married, have a baby, you know, like, you don't have to do that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I could be on my own trying to have a baby, whatever. It was a hit for me. And when I got arrested, I was at a stage where I had definitely let material things take over, and I was already disoriented. So I actually think the arrest snapped me back out of it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. From being disoriented. Mm-hmm. Because the things I don't value and the things that are not the way I am or has been grown up.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I was in a disorientation where I actually think the arrest
snapped you out. Yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And then with my husband's addiction, you know, the last year had been very not great. And I do think I'm actually thankful for the reveal and everything that happened, because I wouldn't want to be 30 years in just trying to figure out why I can't, there's something in my gut, you know? And then it reminded me to always trust your gut.
Yeah.
Because it is real and it is right.
For sure. For sure.
All the time. So again, I feel like I was disoriented and that made me oriented again.
Yeah.
So I do feel like my prayers get answered a lot. Whether it's like a really shitty instance, nobody wants to be cuffed in the back of a cop car, but that it really did, like, this isn't where I want to be. Like, mm-hmm. this isn't who I am. So, yeah, that's
really good.
I'm a vision oriented leader. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So talk to me about that.
I love leadership roles. I love growing teams, getting people to their growth levels in a career and their life. It is empowering for me. People always say, like, you can help someone else, you can't help yourself. Well, I mean, I learned that the hard way, but I love what I learn from other people. And leadership, or I don't treat people like I'm your manager. That's not how I ever, because I learn from you, you learn from me, we collaborate. But I love helping people see who they are. Mm. It's like, it's just so aha moments. I love being a part of where they're just like, yes, I do like doing that. I can't wait to excel here or go work for here or go work at a job here.
Sure.
So I very much like thrive in those type of atmospheres.
Hmm. Do you have any particular vision that, you know what I mean? Like, so when you talk about vision oriented, is there something you're like, this is a vision that I have, this is a thing that I look for or captivated by?
Yeah. I just want to help more children. And like, I'm captivated and I need to, in the next like 3 years, help kids in the system. Mm. I just like, I need to help them. I don't think I don't think we treat children the way we should in the system. I think, well, again, connection. I just, when siblings are separated or things like that, like I know in the next few years, like that's something I have to do.
Mm.
And I'll figure it out.
Are you pretty connected to that community at all?
I am. My CEO is actually a former foster child, and then a very good friend of mine is. And then I've connected myself into the community just to do it because I needed to learn more. I needed to understand where we lack, and we lack a lot.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart too, because, you know, you call kids troubled, but what'd you pull them out of and what'd you put them in? You know, like, where'd you put them? So I think, again, there comes leadership. Like, why are our leaders not helping those kids? So, and kids are just so moldable. They're just so moldable. And, you know, just with the right people in front of them and just guidance and like that one person to speak for them or take them in. So I don't know, like, what that looks like. I see like residential houses of small little families. Somehow nonprofit something and being able to put kids there when they need to, when they get taken out of the home. I just think you have to be desensitized sometimes in a occupation that deals with kids so often, because I couldn't imagine every day. So it just like, you, like, how would you as a child who's five feel if you got a stranger taking you somewhere? Like, I just think there's just so many things we can do to help more. So that's my vision.
That's awesome. So the thing that, and this is not a sweet spot for me, but the thing that I always think about, and I don't know the numbers, but I know they're not astronomical, right? Like, you can just look at the state of Florida and the kids in care and go, the numbers, they're not crazy. There's way too many, but it's like, I mean, go to any church.
400,000 is still a lot.
What's that?
400,000 in foster care.
In the state?
No, just in the U.S. I'm not sure. Florida's probably like 30.
Yeah, right. So, okay, let's just say that's what it is. I don't know the numbers, like I said, but like, I don't think, as I just think about how many people that have a family and how ordinary it is to have a guest room and how many of those people are like church attenders or say they have this value set or whatever, and I'm like, I think this could be over like next week.
Oh yeah, if I could actually convert all the
right if we could just call you to task and be like, that room,
the pro-lifers, that's Jimmy's room to help the kid,
exactly.
Well, and the ones holding the picket signs, like,
well, the problem is are these going to be good places for these people? But right. But in some just economic available, like, wait, you have a family, you have a great place to live, and you have a empty room. So we're going to bring a couple people over there. How about that?
And it's just, you know, I know foster parents and stuff, and it's a hard road, and they take on that emotional. So that's something that's future for me, but
that's awesome.
But something, just because I think kids are so cool and they just crack me up and the things they say. Like sometimes when my son will like push on my stomach and be like, "We learned about whale blubber from a whale," and I was like, "That's rude."
Ouch, jeez,
kid. I was like, "Huh, that's not that nice." but you know, it is what it is. But we get to do this all over again next week, and I'm super excited.
I am too. So I'll tell you what. Is there? Okay. Are there anything? Is there anything that you want for those listening, like things that you want to plug, things that you want to call attention to? Just
katyrae.com, katyrae.com. I know I sound like a country singer, but I'm not.
Hold on, I gotta time you out. So I had my administrative assistant with the well, Martha, was in here earlier. I'm like, and I typed your name in my calendar wrong, so it said Cat Ray. She's like, "Who's Cat Ray?" I was like, "Cat Ray." Oh, Katie. I'm talking to Katie in a little bit, and then she's like, "Is she like she sounds very Southern."
No, my husband's Cuban. And I was like, we're so far from it, but for my wedding, he like made a joke and I started singing to like country.
I love it.
But
sorry, go on.
No, that's hilarious because I always introduce myself as Katie Ray, so it sounds like my middle name.
Yep.
So like it's like I love that you have that story. So katyrae.com, at the real K Ray. Also Cray, if you think about it, because I'm Cray. And Not a Great Whisperer podcast. So yeah, for anything, for interviews, speaking events, helping any group of people. I think put on this earth to just get people to love themselves and enjoy sharing their stories and just have fun while doing it. I love that we were connected. I love your basis of your podcast. I was always like, mine's just so like, you know, people might not get what I mean, ordinary people have been extraordinary lives, you know? And I just love that. I love that we started at the same time too, around the same time, super cool. And I think we were meant to like meet. So I just think big things happen. I think collaboration from everywhere, staying connected, and helping people is just one of my things, because I do think everyone is so unique in their own little ways. Thanks for letting me just talk of your podcast. I could talk Dave.
that's where it's why I like to leave so much space, you know. It's like I we can bang out a handful of questions and get the gist of your story, but I'm like because honestly people will often be like, well, you know, the whole like, well, the good advice is you want to have a real solid niche, whatever, however you say that word, and then you don't want to be so long and whatever, and I genuinely, I think I don't care at all, because I'm like, well, this is actually for me. So like I am doing something here. Like I realize like this is a topic that I want to keep talking about, and I can't generate endless content around out of ex nihilo, out of my mind. But I'm like, you know what though? Everybody has a story and a relationship with their work that I think I, based on some ideas I have, can just pick at it. And go, oh, what's there? And then find what emerges, and you know,
the beauty.
So here's a theme. Here's a theme that emerges among folks I talk to, and I don't think we've touched on it all. So I'll just ask you explicitly rather than it emerging. Flow state. So you're familiar with this concept, right? Yeah. So I'm just curious, in your own life, and whether it's work or just in life, like, are there certain activities that you just lose yourself in, that you lose track of time and eating and, you know, self-consciousness, where you just kind of go into that place where you're like, I thought I was here. It could have been 30 minutes. It was 8 hours or whatever, that kind of timeless experience.
I don't because really? My mind is so moving, but there has been times I've been reading that I just zone out and I'm like
in caught the up in the story oh, like, in the flow it. Of like, the story yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ones that really like but I you know just like meditation is really hard for me and I try it all the time. It's really just lately I've just been trying to focus on walking into a room and being present at that time.
It's really good.
Like that's it. Like that is my first step to my meditation practice is just literally being present, not having my phone out with the kids, not doing like little things that I know that I do sometimes, but like I keep working on my job after hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's just like literally walking into a room, being present and not judging everyone when you walk in, you know, like when you walk in, you're like, I know that person from there, that, and it mm-hmm. just keeps your mind going. It's like literally just being there. Maybe some people are like, she's high. I don't know. But like, I literally just stand there in the room and try to just like enjoy that moment. It's hard. Mm-hmm. It's super hard.
It is. And we, you know, it's not like our phones have done us any favors with the,
oh God,
if no. you're already prone to have attention issues.
I will scroll for days. Yeah. I gotta like just put it away and hide it.
What are you scrolling on?
Oh, just pick. I just take pictures, just liking people's stuff, just being Instagram. Nice. Just like meow, meow. Yeah. Oh yeah, IG. And I'm just like beep beep beep. But no, LinkedIn's been a problem one time. Like sometimes, mm-hmm. like it's just funny because, it's just I push marketing and I do this and I tell them like it's a love hate for me. I want to encourage people that day. I want to send a good quote or something like that. But then I'm like, I don't want to be on social today. So it's like, it's definitely a love hate, but I've noticed my kids will be like, mom, put your phone away. And that
wow.
will not while I'm scrolling, but like while I'm emailing and I'm like, I have to answer this email. And I'm just like, okay, you're right. And so I tell them, you know, sometimes I'm sorry, like, you know, they're right. Wow. And you can tell the difference of their attitude when they have your full attention or when they don't.
Yeah.
And that's for everybody. That's for adults too.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. You on TikTok?
No, I can't. I would be on it all day.
It's a problem. I still have it on my phone, but I'm like, I'm
TikTok.
I would is be on what?
She sends me TikToks, and I know that if I was on it, I would be sending her like 100. But like, they're funny. They're funny.
It well, and it's funny when it as it came out, I was like, this is now. It's evolved a bit, but I'm like, this is because so once upon a time we were on Facebook and then it got real ugly in there. And then I was like, you know what? Instagram is just pictures and it's way less political. It's way less volatile. It's way less, you know, but then it started changing in there as well. And then then TikTok may still have a lot of this, but like, it just like felt fun, like it's just music like and fun, dancing and joking and like funny, and I'm like, oh, this is a really happy and young place, very creative, and the tools that are in it. The main reason I initially downloaded it was there's film editing tools in this app that like I can splice videos together. I didn't have a tool to do that, so I was like, I just want that tool, and then I start scrolling, and I'm like, oh, this is a dangerous place. This is endlessly.
Yeah.
And it literally is endless. And I was curious if that's what you were scrolling.
I can't do any of that. I have to like, yeah. And especially because phones now tell you your screen time. So I don't want my report to be bad, you know?
Yeah. Circle back to the topic of addiction, right?
Yeah. Oh, 100% social media is part of it.
It's just
the instant connect. You can see it in kids now. And it's super sad. Like they're like, I got a like, and you're like, it doesn't validate your like. This isn't validation.
That little bit of dopamine is nice though. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. And it's just like, just being aware and, you know, we can all help someone.
Well, I, real quick, I'm curious if you know this. So, cause some of it's by design. Well, all of it's by design, but like literally the programmers, the maker. So like, and I don't know the most recent update of Instagram, but it's a good example that I knew about. So there was a behavior change, analyst, he's a teacher, professor, this guy BJ Fogg, and he writes about behavior change. He's got a great book out called Tiny Habits, and it's about like you familiar with that? So but one of the things I remember him talking about Instagram, and there was, I think it was related to his class even, was like, if you open the app, there's like this little area where there's that heart, where it's going to have a dot on it of someone likes something like notification or whatever that's in there when you open the app. And he's like, if you ever notice when you open the app, he's like, it's not long, but it's like a 2/3 of a second before it turns red. And he's like, what that does, and you don't know this, it creates pain. So it's mild, but it creates cognitive pain and anticipation. So that there's not immediately there, it's delayed intentionally so that you're like, oh God, nothing. And then it turns red. You're like, oh, there's something there. And you click it. And it's because it's wiring you. It's actually programming you, right? Like, it's like, oh, here's a little dopamine. Here's a little pain and a pain reliever. A little pain and a pain reliever. And I've been endlessly fascinated with the idea. Well, with both those programs, but also just the idea of, I mean, honestly, neuroplasticity as a whole. I'm like, the idea that we can transform ourselves, that we can make decisions and habits that will change us for better or worse over time. We can make decisions today that'll make us a monster tomorrow, or the person we, the vision oriented, right? What we aim toward or want to go toward. And
Want to apologize to your listeners if you hear kids screaming.
Well, if kids are screaming, and I actually think we've covered a lot of bases. So I'll let you go deal with your screaming kids. Thank you so much for your time. And then you and I should be connecting again soon. So I look forward to that.
Super excited, John. Thank you so much. Love what you're doing. I appreciate you having me.
Hey, real quick before you go, I want to invite you to join the conversation. One of the first comments that was left on one of the first episodes was somebody saying that they wanted to join in the conversation the entire time. And I've heard that from a few of you, and I really want to invite you to do that. So if you go to workethicpodcast.com, there is a link to join the conversation where you can click that link and chime in, maybe answer what success is to you, what's your earliest memory of work, your own experience of what triggers flow state, or your own understanding of grit. But I want to invite you to join the conversation. I would also like to invite you to help grow this conversation and this podcast and show. So if you would, please share, please subscribe, please leave feedback on the show, rate it, comment on socials. And then if you would, please, please, please consider supporting the cost, the expense that this show is becoming, and also kind of my own work with the podcast and with the Well and Well Built Bikes. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/theworkethic, or there's also a link at workethicpodcast.com. Thank you so much for considering it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for being a part of this conversation and this project.